Today's show is brought to you by Underbrush, a new thriller by Kevin Carr. There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies, the only show where the host almost always wears pants. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new movies, Paul Blart 2, Monkey Kingdom, which is not about Congress, it's about actual monkeys in the jungle, Unfriended, True Story, and Beyond the Reach. We'll also talk about some news, a very complex trailer park coming up, box office predictions, and of course the world famous DVD roundup. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to hit me up on Twitter, you can find me at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
That's right. Let's launch right into the news. There's a couple smaller stories because I actually have a little bit more I'm going to talk about with the trailer park. But the first piece of news is The Cabin in the Woods, the movie that came out 3 years ago that was delayed for like 2 years up before that, is finally the center of a lawsuit with Drew Goddard, the director, and Joss Whedon, the co-writer and producer, on the chopping block. Apparently, this guy claims that he wrote a similar story about kids that go to a cabin in the woods, and they were being, they're sort of a subject to an experiment of some sorts. Aside from the fact that Cabin in the Woods itself was a deconstruction of the genre, so relied almost entirely on cliches to tell its own brilliant story, which, of course, in turn, would have some cross-connectional material with kind of everything in the genre. Isn't it interesting that it took this guy this long to find Cabin in the Woods, watch it, and then track down who wrote and directed it, even though it's in there in the opening and ending credits? Here's why this thing stinks to high heaven. It's the same reason why that guy who sued Bryan Singer last summer stunk to high heaven. He happened to come out with the lawsuit right before X-Men Days of Future Past came out. What's opening in the theaters in just a couple weeks in American theaters, actually in fewer time in foreign theaters, like a week ahead of time? Avengers Age of Ultron, which is, of course, directed by Joss Whedon. It's his big follow-up to the Avengers. Why did this guy coincidentally wait until this guy just wants a payday. Whenever you sue somebody and it just coincidentally happens around the big release of a movie, that's usually why it's going on. If you really were wronged, take it up with him in 2012, because guess what? There was an Avengers movie out that summer, too. The next piece I want to talk about is The Simpsons, even though this is television, not movies, but it is no longer going to be released on DVD and Blu-ray. I'm assuming there's the DVDs and Blu-rays of the seasons are up to, what, like 18 or so? There's 20-some seasons of The Simpsons, and I think they've released like 17 or 18 of them. So there's like 10 left. Well, they've said they're not going to release anymore. And the reason, supposedly, is because the sales are down, which is BS. The reason that The Simpsons is being pulled from future DVD releases and Blu-ray releases is because FXX, the cable network, has exclusive rights to the reruns, and they do all the every Simpsons episode ever. And there's also a new Simpsons app, a proprietary app that you can sign up for and watch any Simpsons episode you want. Here's the problem with that. Whenever Hollywood tries to make something proprietary that originally wasn't, it's one thing to take Game of Thrones and make that proprietary, because that's HBO's. And they're already fighting piracy every single season with this show. But eventually you can get Game of Thrones on disc if you really want to. It would be like if HBO refused to release it on disc. You're going to see people pirate the heck out of it. You're going to see people, the real fans, are going to end up finding the episodes of The Simpsons. People will have burned them already. People have already gotten them. I mean, there's been enough digital recording that you could do that. The biggest problem with FXX is that they don't project it in the right aspect ratio. They crop it so that it fills the screen because people get weird if you see black bars. Well, guess what? The old time square aspect ratio does not fit on a widescreen TV. People just don't accept that. And so FXX is going to the lowest common denominator. This is a problem because all this stuff already is out there and there's going to be piracy of this thing nonstop and I don't have any sympathy for Fox on this because they're trying to control the marketplace too much. Just license it out there and get the money for the licensing. And that's how the flood the market with it and make it extremely available to people. And you're going to reduce piracy quite a bit. The last piece of news is Wonder Woman, the movie Wonder Woman, has lost its director, Michelle MacLaren, and she supposedly left for creative differences. Ironically enough, Warner Brothers then went and hired Patty Jenkins, who's only directed in theaters Monster, that movie with Charlize Theron about 10, 15 years ago, and she was supposed to do Thor 2, but then she left Thor 2 for creative differences. And a lot of people are making this big deal because, well, Wonder Woman should be directed by a woman, and I'm not taking issue with that, don't get me wrong. But I don't think you should choose a woman to direct a movie any more arbitrarily because they're a woman than you should to have a man. I don't know why there seems to be this history of, at least in superhero movies, women leaving the director spot because of creative differences. Maybe it's because you're taking them from television and putting them into a movie. And for years, people have been exercising their own stupid, egomaniacal, creative control over a property that exists already. But now Warner's trying to keep control of the properties, and Marvel keeps control of the property. Ultimately, that's why Edgar Wright left Ant-Man, because it wasn't Edgar Wright's complete movie. He had to kowtow to Marvel. So I don't know if there's something like that going on here. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies, and that sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. Now, I'm not going to cover the spoilery Terminator Genesis trailer because I haven't watched it because I don't like spoilers. And I'm really not even going to, I'm not going to even play anything from the Batman vs. Superman trailer because that's such a debacle in its own right. I'll talk about that next week in the news as to why that was such a catastrophe for Warner Brothers. Delayed releases and trying to keep hype up and trailers leaked online. But let's talk about the actual trailers this week. Sinister 2, which opens on August 21st, later this summer.
You don't stop evil. You can only protect yourself from it.
There are references to Bagul across all cultures. Some believe that it fed off of the corruption of innocence. There are always three things in common. There's a murdered family, a house, and some form of offering.
I really enjoyed the first Sinister. This one looks like it's a sequel. I'll give it that. It does not look as good as the original, but it looks like it has some interesting things going on. The problem is, it's very difficult to do an authentic horror movie sequel because you want to resist the temptation to explore too much into the bad guy or the demon or the antagonist. Giving them too much humanity ruins that, which is kind of what they did in Insidious 2. But on the flip side, you don't just want to retread the first movie without the bigger stars in it, and that kind of looks like they might be doing both in this one. So I hold out hope, because I like the first one as much as I did. The next trailer I want to talk about is, of course, Star Wars The Force Awakens. Another teaser dropped, not telling much story, but giving a lot of things to look at and listen to.
The Force is strong in my family. My father has it. My sister has it. You have that power too. Chewie, we're home.
Of course, Star Wars The Force Awakens opens December 18th. I am highly interested in this movie. What's interesting is this trailer did not have the level of excitement from me that the first teaser did. Because that first teaser had a nice build and then an exciting launch of the Star Wars theme, which brings tears to your eyes if you grew up in the 70s. This one has an interesting mix of nostalgia baiting, and I've heard people complain about that, but what do you get? It's a teaser. And I like the fact that they're not revealing too much of the story. And we're still, what, 7, 8 months away, 9 months away from this? You had a nice taste of the new stuff, but I think the new stuff does look a bit like the J.J. Abrams Star Trek. Like, there's a scene where their land speeder's going against, in the backdrop, you see a wrecked Imperial Star Destroyer. Well, that kind of looks like the scene where Kirk drives up to a starship in dry dock. I'm okay with seeing, I thought it was cool to see Han and Chewie again. And yeah, they're basically in the exact same pose from one of the most famous stills of them from the original 1977 movie. I'm a sucker for this. I like the fact that they don't give away too much. You got to see a little bit more. And a lot of stuff is getting revealed at Celebration, Star Wars Celebration, this week. And I'm looking forward to the full trailer. I just hope they don't give too much away when they actually give one that has story to it. That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about, oh dear God, Paul Blart 2 and Unfriended. There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kuykendall Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Bad boys, bad boys, that's right. Kevin Carr coming at you with Fat Guys at the Movies. We're going to be talking about Paul Blart, who's, of course, a bad boy. Kevin James, of course, in this latest film. Mall cop Paul Blart is back, this time using his mall cop skills to thwart a Vegas casino heist.
Someone's taken down the hotel!
Your uniform, as requested, Officer Blart?
We don't need any backup, Blart.
Neither do I.
If being a security officer was easy, anybody could do it. Takes a certain breed.
I have a confession to make, and that is I did not hate the first Paul Blart mall cop. In fact, I kind of liked it. It was a bit of a guilty pleasure. There was such hate for that movie when it came out, and it stems from Kevin James' association with Adam Sandler. Now, of course, Adam Sandler's company producing this, but you know, the first Paul Blart, that was before Adam Sandler really, really completely ran his name into the ground with movies like Jack and Jill and Grown Ups and Grown Ups 2 and some of the really terrible stuff that Sandler's done lately. This was the beginning of it. And a lot of people hated it, and it was dumb. I did, now, of course, they had Observe and Report come out later that year, and I hated Observe and Report. I thought it was a terrible movie. It was excruciating to watch, made one of my worst films of the year list. When it comes to the first Paul Blart, it was just stupid fun. You know, it's silly and goofy, and it kind of was more of a family, because the worst stuff that happens is some fart jokes or whatever. And, you know, kids and families are all about fart jokes. So I wasn't dreading this one, and I'm not saying that I should have been dreading this one, but I'm not saying it was anything to look forward to either. It's a sequel, and sequels for movies that you don't intend to initially have a sequel to are really tough to do. And this one falls into all the traps because it has these characters that they have to take care of. Jemma Mays, who played his love interest in the last movie, apparently she wasn't coming back for this. So they had to kind of work around a lot of stuff in this movie. And it's very awkwardly worked around, and it becomes a story between him and his daughter, and his daughter was a little more of a secondary character in the first movie, and she's not bad. The girl who plays his daughter is fine. She has a great knack for humor, but it feels like a crappy Adam Sandler movie. It just has Kevin James in it, and it's Kevin James doing his shtick a little too much to the camera. We get it, Kevin. You're fat. And there's only so much whimsical fat humor I can take. I mean, I made a fat joke at the beginning. I made a joke about me not wearing pants. And maybe that's not a joke. But I make fat jokes all the time, but I don't just inundate the world with fat jokes. You gotta have something more. And the slap, there's some funny moments. There's some nice pratfalls, but overall, you know, it just wasn't very good. It felt like a direct-to-DVD sequel. It felt like, it felt like it was a Disney Channel original movie where they forgot to cast tweens in the lead roles and they accidentally cast Kevin James. It's very cheap in terms of its humor, and it's not well-conceived. And there are scenes that just kind of go on that shouldn't. They should end at a certain point, and they don't. And it was only an hour and a half long, so ultimately, I gotta say that Paul Blart 2 kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Oh, okay.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next film I want to talk about is Unfriended. The ghost of a girl who has committed suicide apparently comes back to haunt her classmates on social media.
Hey, guys. What are you guys doing?
Who is that?
I just tried to hang up on him.
Can you get rid of this person?
I don't know.
Is this here the whole time?
This is probably a glitch.
Well, the glitch just typed.
Who is doing this? This is Laura's account.
Who would hack into a dead girl's account?
Why are you showing this?
Man, what's going on?
What is it?
Hey, talk to us!
I'm signing off.
No, I will kill you.
If there is anything you've learned about me in horror films over the last couple years, it's that I absolutely, utterly hate most found footage movies. I say most because there's some that are okay. I was okay with The Blair Witch. I got nauseous watching it, but it was kind of one of the first of its kind, and I liked Cloverfield for what it was. And the VHS movies are pretty good. The third one's not very great, but the first two are pretty decent. So I've seen some decent found footage movies, which is different than a mockumentary. And I like something like The Sacrament, I'd put in mockumentary rather than found footage, because a mockumentary is something where people are ostensibly going in for real, honest-to-God professional interviews. And it becomes a fake documentary, even if it devolves into, a horror show, which is what happened in The Sacrament. I don't like just the guy who has a video camera who insists on videotaping everything. We saw that in Chronicle, which I hated. We saw that in Project Almanac this year, which I hated. We saw that with Project X, which wasn't even a horror movie or sci-fi movie. And it was absolute steaming pile of doggy poo. Unfriended plays like a found footage movie. And it is, essentially, but it's all takes place literally on one computer screen. It's these kids on a Skype call. And they're all in there talking to each other, and there's this ghost haunting their machines. I have to say, I didn't hate it. I didn't love it, but I didn't hate it. It was mildly interesting. And yeah, it's like 80 minutes long, so it's pretty short. But part of it is maybe because the entire screen wasn't moving around like a found footage movie. And the individual boxes on there are the people's laptops. But ultimately, it was all mostly taking place with these people just staring at their laptops. So you didn't get that nauseating feel of found footage. It does suffer from what found footage movies often suffer from, which is poor character development, poor story exposition, poor reveals. Like, there's scenes that there's not a whole lot of explanation offered. Whereas if you made a movie like this that was a traditional film, there's always that scene in the movie where you have to explain what people are seeing and what people have, why this is happening and how this is happening and what exactly is happening. And they sort of hint at it, and it's discovered in this movie, but it's really awkwardly done. It's not very well written. And ultimately, when you look at the kids, you're just like, these kids are terrible people. Cause of course they're learning more about them, and you're finding out what they've done in the past and what their secrets are. And I mean, they're really terrible people. When you lose the sympathy for the characters, you lose the horrific element to the movie. If you don't care about what happens to the characters, or if the characters are so repulsive that you really kind of want to see them get their just desserts, unless that's the point, then you lose any sort of sympathy for the actual characters. You don't have the Laurie Strode from Halloween. The girl, she's got her own sins and baggage that make it a problem. And then also it all hinges on these kids not being able to just turn off their computers. Close the laptop. Unplug the machine. Take out the battery. At some point, you can disconnect. But I don't know, maybe it's trying to say something profound about how this generation cannot disconnect, which is absolutely true. And I actually talked about that last week when I was talking about While We're Young, that Adam Driver and Ben Stiller movie, where Adam Driver's character was like 25, but he was like, oh, no, we need to disconnect. And that's totally unlike people in that generation. Teens and early 20s are nothing but constantly connected to the internet. But, you know, Unfriended, I don't know. I'm really on the fence on this one. I can't say whether I liked it or didn't like it. I'm really on the fence. I'm going to say, just for the sake of argument, that it's kind of rocks. And I know there's a lot of people saying it's innovative and neat, but, you know, we had The Babadook come out on DVD this week, and we had It Follows come out in theaters very recently. You can't suddenly call Unfriended a quality, unique, and new and different horror movie. But I'm just going to have to say it kind of rocks, because it wasn't terrible.
It kind of rocks.
And on that completely profound and unwavering note, let's go to a break. And then when you come back, I'm going to be talking about Monkey Kingdom and True Story. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. We're going to be talking about a true story, ironically called True Story. Isn't that amazing? You see what Hollywood did there, people? Those people are geniuses out there in California. In True Story, Jonah Hill plays a disgraced newspaper reporter who stumbles onto an interview of a lifetime, that of a man accused of killing his wife and children.
Hello?
Hi, I'm a reporter with the Oregonian. I wanted to get your side on the Christian Longo story.
Who?
He murdered his entire family.
Why are you telling me this?
Because when they apprehended him, he said he was Mike Finkel of the New York Times.
Thank you for seeing me, Mr. Longo.
Call me Chris.
So why me?
I followed your whole career. I guess I felt like I knew you. I want to tell you my side of this. Only you. Maybe at this point it doesn't matter.
When I first heard about this movie, I honestly thought it was going to be a comedy because it stars Jonah Hill and James Franco. And even though Jonah Hill hasn't done a whole lot with James Franco, I think me and a lot of people in the world look at him as sort of like Seth Rogen light or Seth Rogen heavy, just depending on where each of them are in their weight loss cycles. They kind of all come from that same breed of filmmakers and sort of that same graduating class of comedy. But of course, I mean, James Franco's done some pretty great dramatic stuff. Arguably, as good as his comedy is his true dramatic stuff. His cheesy stuff, like in the Spider-Man movies, it's pretty terrible. And like when he was doing movies like Annapolis and Flyboys and these sort of would-be blockbusters, his dramas can actually be really a compelling actor. I mean, look at 127 Hours. He was fantastic in that movie. And in this one, he is also doing a dramatic role. Just forget the fact that he released the interview a couple months ago. Jonah Hill is not going out there to interview Kim Jong-un. Jonah Hill plays a real-life character, a real reporter who used to work for the New York Times and kind of got busted doing some, let's just say, unethical is, I think unethical is a harsh word to use for what happened. He basically merged some stories of sources into one and kind of made an amalgamation character that focused on what, you know, a lot of the problems that happened in this region of Africa. And he took some liberties with the actual narrative of what happened, but all the stuff is true. So he lost his job at the New York Times. When you lose your job at the New York Times, and it's because you took some liberties with your source materials, you tend not to work somewhere else anytime soon. But what happened was this killer, or alleged killer, was on the run from the police, and he was using this New York Times writer's name. When he got caught and he was jailed, he decided to give an interview to the reporter. And it is this weird, in cold blood kind of setup. If you've ever, you know, either read In Cold Blood or seen In Cold Blood or watched the movies made out of it, like Capote or Infamous, then it's the story of this reporter who is interviewing a guy and trying to find out whether he actually killed anybody, whether he did the crime and at what level he did it and how this is revealed. And it kind of pulls the veil back on true crime writing, which isn't as big of a deal now, but boy, back in the 80s, it was a big deal. I mean, of course, In Cold Blood was written in the 60s, but that became very popular in the 70s and 80s, these true crime novels. And while you still find them all over the place, they kind of hit their heyday in the 80s. And that was the one that always got TV movies made out of them. And ironically, even though it was a big book, this book, True Story, for the writer, it was a big deal. He kind of got in a little too deep with his source material and with his character. And it's an interesting movie. It's a slower burn. It's not a fantastic, in-your-face, intense movie. I mean, this is not Clarice Starling interviewing Hannibal Lecter. This is a little more down-to-earth, and it's almost, to a fault, it's almost mundane. But it's fascinating, and I find it fascinating because I'm in journalism, and I've done interviews. I don't think I've interviewed any murderers. But I mean, when I did more interviews, I interviewed movie stars and stuff. But it's a fascinating look at what it takes to be a writer and sort of how things can turn on a screw and how quickly they can happen and sort of where the evil resides and what is going on behind the eyes of this guy who's in jail and what his endgame plan is. So I think it's a neat movie. It's going to be totally forgotten, which is kind of sad because I think you could have gotten a little bit of note in award season, but it's coming out in April and Fox Searchlight generally, I mean, unless it's like a Wes Anderson movie, you can't release it that early in the year and really expect people to remember it. So while it's a well-acted and well-constructed movie, it's not overwhelming. It's not overpowering, but it's an interesting movie and it's worth checking out. So if you have a chance to see and you want to see something different, check out True Story. It kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys of the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next film I want to talk about is Monkey Kingdom. Ooh, chimpanzee, that monkey news. Fans of the Ricky Gervais radio show might recognize that. People who know nothing about Ricky Gervais's radio show are going to think I just went insane and I'm flinging my poo against the wall, which who knows, maybe I am. Like I said, I'm most likely wearing pants at the moment. In celebration of Earth Day, Disney Nature releases its latest family-friendly documentary about a group of monkeys living in the jungles of Asia.
Disney Nature invites you to meet Maya and her very curious newborn, Kip. They're playful, adventurous, and facing the world together. But now, unexpected trouble will put them in danger, and Maya and her family will need a new place to call home.
I love nature films. I love good nature films. Now, you can go watch Animal Planet, and you see a lot of crap out there because it's sort of churned out. And that's not a diss on Animal Planet. They just have to fill 24 hours of programming with nature films, and not everything can be Planet Earth from the BBC. But I love like that Planet Earth series on the BBC. I've got it on Blu-ray. It's gorgeous. And I also love the old Disney nature films that they did in the 60s and 70s. That stuff was fascinating. It was old school and it was different, but I thought that was great. And what I loved about that and what Disney, the company, is doing is as much as they have now, of course, the Star Wars properties and they got Pixar and they've got all of Lucasfilm and they've got all of Marvel, they're not only about making money. Yes, Disney makes money and it's a profit company, but they're willing to make and release a movie like Monkey Kingdom, which is not going to win any awards. It may have a shot at some family-friendly documentary, but it's not going to win Best Documentary. They never do. And these things never make a ton of cash, but, you know, Disney is willing to do that for a little bit of education, a little bit of family-friendly infotainment, I guess you could say. And I remember a couple years ago, I took my whole family to go see African Cats when that came out. And that was a lot of fun. And I took my son last year to see Bears. And many years before that, I took my kids on Earth Day to go see, because it was happened to be Take Your Kids to Work Day. Back when they released Earth and then Oceans, the 2 years in a row. It was Take Your Kids to Work Day. Well, what do I do for a job? I go see movies. So I took them out of school and I went to go see these movies and I had them go on the radio with me and talk about it. And it was a lot of fun. So, these are great movies for kids. And yeah, they play a little fast and loose with the chronology on these. And yeah, they kind of manufacture story a bit because it's a 90-minute movie. And sometimes they're waiting for months to get these shots and they edit stuff together so it looks a little more narrative. It gives it a better narrative. And that's very apparent with Chimpanzee, one of the Disney nature films. And if you watch this one, you watch Chimpanzee and you watch African Cats, they all follow the same basic story where they follow this group of animals that live in a certain place. And then there's outsider animals that are coming in to sort of take over, either take over the land or take over the hunting grounds. And then they have to go away and then they have to come back and regain where they had. I mean, it's very similar in the setup and story as that's basically what happens in Chimpanzee and African Cats. And there are certain shots where you're like, well, I know they manufactured it. Like there's a scene where the monkeys go into town, like a gang, like a roving street gang. And they raid a kitchen. Well, obviously, they had how many different camera setups did they have in there? They probably just set up a bunch of cameras and just kind of let the monkeys go at it. Not really. They didn't sneak in there. But I mean, it makes it a nice little story. And it's cute. And it's definitely something kids can watch. It's not overly violent or dangerous. I mean, you don't have animals. There's a couple animal deaths in there, but they're pretty bloodless. So ultimately, you know, I love these movies. These are great. I think Monkey Kingdom rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
All right, I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Beyond the Reach, the box office, and the world-famous DVD Roundup. Elizabeth Stokes' new romance novel, Five Nights in Vegas, is about meeting, getting married, and falling in love, in that order. Lexi Frost is a cocktail waitress in a Las Vegas casino. Nate Zimmerman is a marketing executive from back east. After a chance meeting on Nate's business trip, they wake up to discover they got married at an all-night wedding chapel. During their whirlwind attempt to undo their mistake, Lexi and Nate discover they might just be made for each other after all. Five Nights in Vegas by Elizabeth Stokes is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. You're back with Fat Guys of the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's finish up with one more movie that's opening this week in smaller release. It's called Beyond the Reach. It stars Michael Douglas as the most recognizable name in it. In the film, a tracker agrees to take a rich hunter into the desert in search of big game, but he ends up being hunted himself when the hunter accidentally kills someone. Oops.
Ben, got a job here for you this morning. Guy wants to go out to the Reach.
Early in the season, isn't it?
Got himself a special exemption. Best tracker in the state.
Well, imagine that.
I can get it done.
We need to take him to town.
Ben, the situation's more complicated than you think. Take off your clothes.
Okay.
This would be murder.
No. I'm not killing you. I'm just gonna watch you die.
I'm a little conflicted with this movie. I tend to be conflicted with a lot of movies this week. Hey, it's April. This is what happens. There's some parts of this movie that I genuinely enjoyed. I thought Michael Douglas's performance was 90% really pretty good. He plays the rich guy who hires the tracker to take him out into the desert. He has a couple moments, though, that are just alarmingly terrible. But, you know, hey, he's old and he's batty, and I'm sure he's... You know, he did this movie, and I applaud him for doing a smaller movie like this. I mean, he's coming out with he's going to be an Ant-Man in July, and he comes out with this little thing. So I always like to see it when an actor who's well-known and still in the game shows up in these smaller little movies. The film has an interesting setup. It's a mistake that he accidentally kills this guy. It's literally a grizzled old prospector, practically. And then he wants the tracker to help him out and sort of cover it up because he doesn't want it to find out that he accidentally shot somebody because he's afraid of his business competition because he's extremely wealthy and he's selling his business overseas. And then, of course, he turns on him when he doesn't play by the rules and he sends him out into the desert. But, of course, because the tracker knows the desert, he knows the whole area. He's able to figure out what to do, and he gives him a little bit more of a run for the money. We've seen this kind of man-hunting man film before, and there's some great moments. There's some parts where Michael Douglas kind of chews the scenery with some of his dialogue and his taunting, but you know, it's beautifully shot. The biggest problem is the star of the film, the main guy in it, is Jeremy Irvine, and the most recognizable thing I remember him from is he was in War Horse. He kind of played the main character who had the horse. There's a reason he never broke out into stardom was because he's kind of a boring, good-looking guy. And that's about it. There's really nothing compelling. I mean, in War Horse, I loved the movie War Horse, but I didn't necessarily like it for Jeremy Irvine. I mean, the horse had more personality than he does. And on top of it, part of what makes his character survive and his focal point to keep him alive when he's out in the 130-degree sun, he is thinking of the girl that he loves, and we see there at the beginning. And that's just such a cliche. And there's nothing special about their relationship. Their interaction, we see brief interaction with them in the beginning and flashbacks. And there's nothing about it that makes it pop. It's just two attractive yet fiercely boring actors playing off each other. The movie also, while it's an interesting sort of suspense, it reminds me of stuff that if you're like watching HBO or Showtime late at night and you're watching just some late night movie sometime, that's what you'd run into in the 90s. That's what it really felt like. But it worked for what it was until it gets to the last half of the last act. It's just sort of like the ending of the movie really falls apart. And I mean, like, colossally falls apart. It almost feels like they reshot the ending and it gets a little bit silly in some ways. I mean, it was okay if you like this kind of mano-a-mano kind of movie. Very small cast, very limited locations. I mean, it's vast because it's in the desert, but it's very limited location. It just doesn't hold together as a cohesive movie as well as it should. So that's why I'm going to actually have to say that Beyond the Reach kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Oh, okay.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the box office now. I predicted that Furious 7 was going to make $60 million in its second weekend. I was really close. I was like off by $315,000. I was so close to being dead on. It was actually tracking it a little higher, and that basically just shows that this movie is, even though it's making tons of money, it's still relatively front-loaded. Most of its money came in the first week and a half to 2 weeks, and it's going to be dropping, and then it's going to get creamed when Avengers comes out. It's still going strong, but at $60 million, that's because it had a $140-some million opening weekend. It dropped almost 60%, which is expected for a film like this. So it doesn't necessarily have these huge legs. It's just they're thick legs. Then the Longest Ride came in. Now, what's interesting about The Longest Ride, it came in with $13 million, and I've heard it reported, well, this is about on par with what The Notebook did. But you got to remember, The Notebook, A, was 10 years ago, so you had 10 years of inflation. And it actually came in a little less than The Notebook. The Notebook was the first really huge Nicholas Sparks movie, and then there are other ones like Dear John that made a lot more money, and he's definitely on a downslope. This didn't go as far down as The Best of Me, but it's not much better than The Best of Me in terms of box office. I mean, as long as he's able to continue to make movies on the cheap, he can make these movies and get $30, $40 million in the theaters, and that might be enough to cover it. But, you know, he can't expand beyond it. So while this is a success for how small of a movie it is, it's hardly a runaway success, and it's not a surprise. This week, that you've got Paul Blart, you've got Unfriended, and you got Furious 7 that are all kind of vying for first place. I think Furious 7 is going to hang on. And I think it's just going to barely beat Paul Blart. Because Paul Blart is a dumb, goofy, family-friendly in the sense that it's not horribly offensive comedy. And we haven't had one of those, I mean, outside of, like, Home. There really isn't that family comedy out there that middle school kids can go to. And Paul Blart works for that. And it's not as awful as, like, Grown Ups and Jack and Jill and those movies, how bad those movies became. That's My Boy. I think it's still going to have a little bit of legs. I think if they make a Paul Blart 3, it's not going to make any money, but I think this could still make a little bit of money and be popular with the masses. I think it would be hilarious if it beat Furious 7, being the one weekend that Furious 7 is knocked off its pedestal, but I still think Furious 7 has enough gas to get it past Paul Blart. And then Unfriended, you know, I think this is the kind of movie that goes straight for the teenage audience, and I think that audience is going to love it, but I think most of that money is going to be made on Thursday night and Friday, and then it's going to crash on the weekend. It's going to be horribly front-loaded, and it will drop off extremely fast after this weekend, but it'll still make a little bit of cash. But my final prediction for Furious 7 is going to be $30 million in the box office this week. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the world-famous DVD roundup. The first one I want to highlight, the big one this week that I actually mentioned earlier in my discussion about Unfriended, is The Babadook, which is a fantastic horror movie that came out last year and really kind of made a splash during award season. And it's always neat to see a genre movie, specifically a horror movie, do well in award season because a lot of times awards aren't given to these kind of movies. The Babadook is creepy. It's well done. It's very low budget, but it's incredibly effective. It's definitely worth checking out. It's about a woman who is a widow, who's raising a troubled and behaviorally defiant son at times, and having to deal with a haunting that's coming after her. A couple other ones you want to check out are Big Eyes, which is the Amy Adams movie where she plays the artist Keen, who of course painted the pictures of the kids with the big eyes and proving that she's the one who did it and not her husband. Maps to the Stars, which is David Cronenberg's latest film starring Julianne Moore and Robert Pattinson. The Man with the Iron Fists 2. This is, of course, the sequel to The Man with the Iron Fists, which was the RZA's movie a couple years ago. And that movie wasn't very good, but it actually had an impressive cast with people like Lucy Liu, and it had Russell Crowe. I mean, there are some names in this movie. There's no names in The Man with the Iron Fists. It's a direct-to-DVD sequel. The RZA's in it, still having iron fists. It's directed by Roel Reyna, who's my favorite direct-to-DVD sequel movie director. He's actually pretty good, just genre director. You know, it succeeded in becoming a crappy kung fu movie, is what it is. And I think that's what they set out to make. There's also Class of 1984, which is a prophetic movie about a high school made in 1982. And this high school is like the worst high school in America. And you've got punks and rapists and murderers who are in the school. And it's about a teacher, a pacifist teacher, who is pushed to the brink. It's a classic film. Definitely worth checking out if you love sort of these crazy 80s movies. It's directed by Mark Lester, who directed, I think he directed Commando as well. So it's a neat movie. Shout Factory released. I think it's under Scream Factory, actually. Besides Still Waters, which is Chris Lowell's directorial debut, you will recognize Chris Lowell from Veronica Mars and Private Practice. This one I reviewed when it came out in theaters, but it's a reunion of old friends, which generally is the kind of story that rubs me the wrong way because they're usually not terribly effectively done. But Lowell manages to actually give a nice, even presentation of it. And I actually like this movie, which I generally don't like these kind of movies. So, you know, good for you, Chris. And finally, the stinker of the week is The Woman in Black 2, Angel of Death. And it's really not that bad. It's just not very good. And it's a huge step down from the first Woman in Black, which helped having Daniel Radcliffe in. Of course, he's nowhere near this movie. That is it. Next week, I'm going to be talking about The Age of Adeline and Ex Machina. And until then, have a fat time at the movies.